Let's open our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 28, verse number 8, and continue the story of Saul's last and fatal rebellion against God. It is the day before the Battle of Mount Gilboa. Mount Gilboa is the southeastern fringe of the Valley of Jezreel. And it is the region in which the Israeli troops have all mustered and bivouacked at Saul's direction to prepare to engage the Philistines who are on the north side of the Jezreel Valley, just north of Jezreel, a few miles, by Shunem. The Philistines are here to take all the supplies that they can get their hands on from the Israelis. And the Israelis are trying to defend themselves against that. Remember that while this is happening here, David is way down south. And he has just been fighting against the Amalekites that kidnapped the families of all his men. So he is a good four days walk, 4 days travel from where King Saul is about to die. So while David is fighting Amalekites in the dark, this is what's happening at Endor, up in the north. Verse 8, Saul disguised himself, he put on other garments, he and his two men with him. They came to a woman by night, and he said, "Divine for me by a spirit, bring up for me whomever I shall name to you." And the woman said, "Surely you know what Saul's done, how he's cut off the mediums and the necromancers from the land. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death?" So she has been driven underground by threat of lethal prosecution by King Saul and his men for practicing occult things like reaching into the spirit world and trying to contact, supposedly, the dead. And so she's like, "Why are you trying to get me killed?" Saul swore to her by he who is, very ironically, "As he who is lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." So he has asked her, "You use your spirit connections into the spirit world to find someone very specific for me that's dead, because I want to get some information out of them." Now, typically, the scripture indicates the dead are not allowed to communicate with the living. That's just pretty much the way it is. But we have a problem that we have a spirit world that is full of these fallen angels, these demonic entities that hate mankind, and they have been running a long con on mankind in regard to these matters. They have gathered a lot of intelligence, a lot of information on all the people that have lived and those that are dead. And so they are able to give what is supposedly intimate information in these sessions to somehow prove that you're talking to a dead relative or a dead friend. So again, it's a very big con game, similar to how some people will pretend that they can read your mind, when in fact, they're just really good at running a con. So Saul is asked by her, "All right, who do you want to talk to? I'll agree, since you swore before God that you won't report me. I'll do it. Who do you want to talk to? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. Now, the way this was supposed to work, and apparently still does work in among modern mediums, is that the medium will send out a message to their own familiar spirits, a spirit in the spirit world that they have a relationship with, and say, you need to find so-and-so, and you talk to them, and then you tell me what they're saying, and then I'll pass that on to the people that are here. So there's not going to be this like direct communication. There's intermediaries. And this allows some humans to actually be the con artists here. They just pretend that they're connecting with the dead world or with the spirit world, when in fact they're just play acting. I don't think that's the case here with this woman. I think this woman really is in touch with demonic beings on the other side. And so her procedure would have been to tell her familiar spirit, go find the spirit of Samuel the prophet. And then that spirit would tell her, okay, I've found him. What do you want to know from him? And so she'd find out from Saul, what do you want to know? She'd pass it on, and then the others would pass it back to her. And it's just a really involved process here, but no direct contact between the two beings. That's part of the con. Now, something happens, though, that freaks her out. She doesn't have contact with her spirit being. She suddenly has direct contact with the spirit of Samuel. And I cannot stress enough here, this is highly unusual. God does not have allowances for the dead to connect with the living. But in this case, he makes an exception to that rule because Saul needs some extra special attention in this rebellion. So she says, she cries out with a loud voice, first of all, because she sees this being that she didn't expect to see. And the woman then said to Saul, why have you deceived me? You're Saul. Apparently, when the spirit of Samuel appears to her, he identifies Saul as King Saul, and that kind of freaks her out as well. But the whole thing is way out of her usual experience. And then the king said to her, don't be afraid. What do you see? So he doesn't see any of this. Remember, I told you there's like these layers involved. And so the woman said to Saul, I see, and I'm going to read the English Standard Version first. I see a God coming up out of the earth. Now, that is an appropriate translation of the word here. The word is Elohim, and I believe it's in its singular form here. But it is also literally the word for mighty one. And so it can sometimes just refer to some sort of powerful spirit being. And so that is what she seems to be expressing, is I see a powerful spirit being coming up out of the earth. And he said, what is his appearance? And she said, an old man is coming up and he's wrapped in a robe. So she describes the appearance of the spirit of Samuel at this time, which is interesting because he, of course, is dead. So he does not have a physical body. He's in the spirit world. But it is interesting that apparently in the spirit world, there is some sort of form that is, it is reminiscent of a physical body. Maybe it's just a comfort thing. Every once in a while I joke and say that it's kind of the loner that God lets you have until you get your brand new body. And so whatever it is, she describes the prophet Samuel in a way that Saul is convinced that this is definitely him, because he says, "Oh, it's Samuel. I know it's Samuel." And then he bows with his face to the ground and he paid homage. Now remember that Samuel was the one that anointed Saul as king 20 years earlier. So Saul feels that he owes this type of respect to Samuel, especially since he needs Samuel's help. That's why he's doing this, as he will explain in a moment. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Now, he's not saying, you know, "I was sleeping and you woke me from my death sleep." He's saying, "Why are you contacting me?" And Saul answered, "I'm in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me. God has turned away from me. He answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams." Not even by Urim and Thummim, remember, which, of course, disappeared after the priests at Nob were killed, and then the ephod was taken away and has been traveling with David, and that's where the Urim and the Thummim are at. So that's why I've summoned you, to tell me what I shall do. So basically, I was at my rope's end. God won't talk to me. I can't get any type of assistance here to figure out what to do with this invasion. And so you're my only hope. You're the one that I had to reach out to. And so Samuel said back, "Why then do you ask me, since he who is has turned from you and has become your enemy? He who is has done to you as he spoke by me, for he who is has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David." So Samuel engages in basically that whole "I told you so" thing. "This is exactly what I told you about. God is done with you, and God has already selected the next king." Verse number 18, "Because you did not obey the voice of he who is, and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek, therefore he who is has done this thing to you this day." And this next part, I think, is the reason God makes the exception here. He allows Samuel to pass on prophetic information to King Saul about tomorrow's battle. Verse 19, "Moreover, he who is will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me," meaning you'll all be dead. It doesn't mean that they'll be in the same place, because Luke chapter 16 has a good description of how before the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the dead were segregated away from God, but also away from each other based on whether they were good dead people or bad dead people. We've got this great gulf that separated the two places. One's usually referred to as Abraham's bosom. That's where all the good people went to wait for Jesus' death and resurrection to happen. And then the other side was called the bases, or the pits, and it was where the wicked people had to wait for their final disposition. And so Samuel is just saying, you'll all be dead. You'll be on this side of the dividing line between life and death tomorrow. He who is will give the army of Israel also into the hands of the Philistines. So it's going to be bad. This is the prediction. So Saul fell at once, full length on the ground, filled with fear because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten nothing all day and all night. So he's not been eating. He's probably been begging God to talk to him through refusing food. Stress, of course, causes us not to eat. And so he's in a mess. And so the woman, the medium, came to Saul after everything was finished with this back and forth, because she's been involved in passing all of these words from Samuel to Saul. So all that's done now. And so she came to Saul and said, she saw that he was terrified. She said, behold, your servant has obeyed you. I've taken my life into my hand. I've listened to what you've said to me. So I put myself out there for you. Now, therefore, you also obey your servant. Let me set a morsel of bread before you. Eat, that you may have strength when you go on your way. So she is concerned that he looks very weak. He was probably looking kind of weak when he came in, and now he's got all this bad news, and so he's even more on the verge of collapsing. And she probably has some sense of pity for him and offers to make him a nice meal. He refused and said, I'm not going to eat. But his servants, because you remember he had some people coming with him, together with the woman, urged him, and he listened to their words. So he arose from the earth and sat on the bed. Now the woman had a fattened calf in the house. She quickly killed it. She took flour and kneaded it and baked unleavened bread of it. And she put it before Saul and his servants, and they ate. And then they rose and they went that night. And this was the final meal that King Saul had before he goes to the battle of Mount Gilboa. And so it was eaten very late into the night. Now, meanwhile, that same night, David and his soldiers were resting after they defeated the Amalekites. So let's return back to their story. This is in chapter 30, and we're right down at verse 21, where it's the next day, which means it's the actual day of the battle of Mount Gilboa. And we know exactly where David's at, and he is many days' travel away from the battlefield. Verse 21, so David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor. They went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. So he went and got everything, and now he's back the next day. These guys were maybe some of the oldest of his warriors that just couldn't do it. They couldn't do like 4 days travel, including fighting. And so they had waited here until David and his 400 soldiers got back. And so David's perfectly fine with that. You can tell that from the text. However, verse 22 says, then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, because they didn't go with us, we're not going to give them any of the spoil that we've recovered, except each man can lead away his wife and children, get out of here. So some of the guys, not all of them, but some of the guys that went and fought against the Amalekites, they're ticked off that these guys were still here waiting. And they're like, they don't get any of our stuff. Because remember, when you fight battles, the spoil belongs to the fighters. It's divvied up. It's divided up as kind of a bonus for being in the battle. And so they're, no, we are not sharing any of the battle bonus with them. They can have their family members, and then they can just leave. But it says that, verse 23, David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what he who is has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter?" So David is like, knock it off. Why would anyone want to listen to your bad attitude? God's the one that gave us this victory, not ourselves. He's the one that brought us through this thing. And so this is what's going to happen. "For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays with the baggage. They shall share alike." Meaning the support personnel in the camp, the battle camp, where all the stuff is kept. The support personnel who are not involved in the actual fighting, they're still going to get a part of the battle spoil because they were doing a part by being in the support unit. And so verse 25 says, "He made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day." So whoever the prophet is that's writing this section in the book of 1 Samuel, he says, that's the reason why when Israeli kings go to war, the people who don't fight but who are in the support camp, they still get a cut of the battle spoils because David said that's the way it's going to be. And since he's king, that becomes law. Verse 26 says that when David came to Ziklag, and more than likely this is late in the day of the battle of Mount Gilboa. But I want to finish up here with this story before we go to the battle of Mount Gilboa. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, "Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of he who is." So he takes a cut of what was recovered, because some of it is actually Philistine spoils that had been taken from Judah. And so he sends this up to Judah, probably up to Hebron, to the leadership there. He says, "This is some of the stuff that I recovered by the work of the Lord. Spread it around, or return it to the people that lost it." It was from those in Bethel. That's Bethel of Judah, not Bethel up in Benjamin. In Ramot of the Negeb, in Yatir, in Erior, in Sifmot, and in Eshtemoa. In Rakal, in the cities of the Jeremielites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormah, Borashan, Atak, and in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men had roamed. So he is particularly interested in keeping up his relationship with the Judeans in and around the Hebron area that he was hiding out among during the last couple of years. A little bit of a thank you, I think, to them for not ratting them out, although some did, but most of them didn't, not ratting him and his men out to King Saul or capturing them and turning them over to King Saul as enemies of the state. All right, so David is back to Ziklag probably the same day that the Battle of Mount Gilboa takes place. That's chapter 31. We'll get started on it, but we won't be able to finish all the details today. Now, the Philistines were fighting against Israel. Remember, the Philistines started on the north central side of the Jezreel Valley, just about 3 or 4 miles north of the city of Jezreel. The Israelis are encamped on the, they're encamped southeast of there on the very extreme edge of Mount Gilboa, and down into the area where there's a big water source to the east of the city of Jezreel. So the battle is engaged right there near Jezreel. And we are told that the men of Israel fled before the Philistines. So they don't have God fighting on their side, and so they lose badly. And when they are routed, they retreat back toward Mount Gilboa to the southeast. And they ended up falling slain on Mount Gilboa. Now, remember, Mount Gilboa is not like just one mountain. It's an entire ridge that's there on the extreme southeast side of Jezreel Valley. And so they're dying in droves all along this transition point from the Jezreel Valley up to the hill country to the south. And eventually, verse 2 is that the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua. So the Philistines end up encircling and then killing King Saul and his bodyguard that's right there with him, no doubt, and his sons that are right there with him. And Jonathan is one of those that died that day.